Welcome back. It's another episode of the Athletic Hockey Show. Ian Mendes and Sean McAdoo, down goes Brown, with you for this one. Ahead on the podcast, we'll ask Sean how he's feeling in advance of a historic matchup between the Montreal Canadiens and Toronto Maple Leafs. Death, taxes, and Nazem Kadri crossing the line in the playoffs. We'll chat about how the Avs center can't seem to stay out of trouble in the postseason. Jesse Granger will drop by for Granger Things. We'll talk about some of the early betting trends that he's seeing in the first week of the Stanley Cup playoffs. We've got some of your questions to tackle, including TV timeouts in overtime. Have they always been a thing? And this week in hockey history looks back at Stefan Matteau's overtime winner and a trade in which the Montreal Canadiens fleeced the California Golden Seals. And as we kick off this show, speaking of the Montreal Canadiens, Sean, I got to get your honest opinion here. I know that every Leafs fan is like, well, you know, we're always nervous and whatever. But like, legitimately, we have waited our entire lifetime. We're not old enough to have remembered a Montreal-Toronto series. So how is down goes Brown, arguably the most famous Toronto Maple Leafs fan, feeling right now on the day of game one?
Yeah, somewhere like Mike Myers and Will Arnett just threw their phones out a window hearing you say that. I'm excited for it. I have been saying all year long, I wanted this matchup. This is going to be great. And it's also going to be horrible. It's going to be absolutely just a disaster for in terms of the next couple of weeks on Twitter, on the call-in shows, on everywhere, because this is the two by far biggest fan bases in the country, and maybe in the league as a whole, going head to head, and it's going to be something to watch. And look, the Leafs on paper are the big favorites. There's no galaxy brain take that I can give you that says that Montreal should win the series. Toronto is better, or at least close enough in just about every line on the checklist that you would go down before a series. But it's the modern NHL. It's the era of parity. Anyone who thinks that this is anywhere close to a sure thing hasn't been paying attention to these teams and hasn't been paying attention to the league. This is a league where you can build a dream team, and you can put them up against a team that is nowhere near them, and you're maybe a 75% chance to win, maybe 80%. That's a big favorite. I don't think the Leafs are that high, but that's about as high as you could get. That's a big favorite. That still leaves a really big chance that you could see an upset, and certainly not to get ahead of ourselves, because again, the Leafs should win this series and maybe even win it relatively quickly. Boy, if Montreal can hang around and make a series of this, and if they could ever win this series, the fallout in Toronto is going to be just all types of madness, from the fan base to the media and everywhere else. It would really be something to see. So not there yet. Again, Leafs should win the series, but the Canadians absolutely have got a shot at this, and it's going to be very nervous times for both fan bases.
Yeah, you know, and I think that this has the potential to end up being arguably the most watched or highest rated broadcast in Canadian and NHL history. I think about it. If you think about it, this is, I think, akin, Sean, to Yankees Red Sox in baseball, where even if you were like a fan of another team, there's really no gray area with the Yankees and Red Sox. And there was some terrific drama and theater. And when iconic franchises meet with the postseason backdrop, I think it just amplifies things. We have not seen Habs Leafs. So I think even if you're a fan of any other team, there's this sort of almost morbid curiosity factor of, you know, I hate them both and I'm going to cheer for maximum chaos. Or I just, you know, and probably maximum chaos would be Toronto losing the series in some way, shape or form, as you outlined. But I think this has the potential to have so many eyeballs on it, because I really think even if you're not a fan of one of these two teams, they elicit so many emotions in you that you're bound to tune in.
Yeah. And I'm curious to see that, because we've seen you know, certainly if you're talking about TV ratings in this country, there seems to be a limit on how many hockey fans you can get to watch an NHL game. If it's just a purely, this is a very interesting NHL game, in this country, you can get 3, 4, maybe 5 million people to watch. But it's when that game jumps the track and becomes something bigger than that. And certainly, I mean, you look at the ratings for the Olympics, that would be the example where Canada's going for a gold medal. Now you're talking 10 million plus numbers that the NHL could never get to. Something like the Raptors going on their run, I think they got up around 7 or 8 million. I think, based on what I was able to Google, that the record in Canada is Game 7 of the Canucks-Bruins series, which maybe is maybe a little bit of a surprise, only because you might think it would be a two Canadian team thing. But at that point, a Canadian team gets to Game 7 of the Stanley Cup, everybody's watching, regardless of who you cheer for. I don't know if a round one series is going to get into that range, unless this becomes one of those series where it really we get all sorts of drama, we get all sorts of storylines. I mean, you mentioned Red Sox, Yankees, you know, we all remember that series with the 3-0 comeback. That was one where even if, and you know, I'm a Blue Jays fan, I kind of get sick of the Yankees and Red Sox. So when that series started, I was probably like, you know, forget it. Here we go again with these guys. By the time it got to game 6 and 7 and the Red Sox were pulling off the comeback, you had to watch. You absolutely were. I mean, it was can't miss television. That could happen with Toronto, Montreal. If it ends up just being more of the garden variety playoff series, I think you'll still see real good numbers, but I don't think you'll get to that same range. But the potential maybe could be there, depending on how it plays out.
Well, I think it's interesting too, and your column that dropped this week talked about what teams are facing the most pressure. And you kind of used this formula where you added some things like what's the roster look like, what's the market pressure on the team. You know, special circumstances. I thought it's interesting because you got the Montreal Canadiens in the top five. And the way that you have the rankings is, I think you got Montreal 5, Boston 4, Vegas 3, Colorado 2, Toronto 1. And it's funny because I look at that and I say, like, well, the Habs are the one team that just don't have Stanley Cup aspirations out of that group, and yet you have them in the top five.
Yeah, and I wound up with Montreal maybe a little higher than I thought. Like you say, I looked at a few factors. One of them was expectations, and I've got the Canadiens ranked real low there. I think most people expect them to lose this series. I have not seen anyone make a case that they're actual contenders to win the Stanley Cup. But then you look at everything else, starting with the fact that it's Montreal. Preseason games are high pressure in Montreal, let alone the playoffs. Let alone the playoffs against the Toronto Maple Leafs. That's just going to magnify everything. But the other pieces that I look at with this team is, you know, that Carey Price is getting up there. Shea Weber's getting up there. This is not an old team in the sense that we usually mean that. And certainly they've got some good young players. They don't seem like they're going to be using most of them in the playoffs, but they at least to start with. But they've got some good young players. So this isn't a team where you say the window is slamming shut. But this is a team where this version, this core of the team does not have that many kicks at the can left. You look at the division that they're in now versus where they're going to be next year, assuming we go back to the standard format. This is the opportunity right here. If you're going to have one more deep playoff run with Carey Price, this is your chance right here. And then on top of that, you know, Dominic Ducharme probably coaching for his job. Mark Bergevin's job may be on the line here too. I mean, if this series plays out the way that a lot of people seem to think it might, which is that Toronto wins relatively easily 4 or 5 games and shows that they're clearly the better team, that's going to really leave an impact in Montreal. And you know, again, in some other markets, maybe you could ask for a little bit of patience and that sort of thing. That's not really how it works in Montreal. And so I do think that this is a situation where I bet if you hook Mark Bergevin up to a lie detector and said, would you rather be playing Edmonton or Winnipeg or somebody like that? I think he'd probably say he would, because this is going to get so much attention that any little flaw, anything that goes wrong, is going to be so magnified and so picked apart. And that has the potential, at least, for both of these teams to really really put a spotlight on them that is not going to benefit them in terms of public perception.
Well, you know, if Toronto doesn't win this series, it'll come back to they don't have enough grit, they don't have enough sandpaper, and they decided to part ways with Nazem Kadri. And Kadri back in the news cycle here, Sean, as Wednesday night, he delivers a high, dangerous hit on Justin Falk, and here we go again. And this is exactly what the Toronto Maple Leafs felt like. They probably couldn't trust Nazem Kadri, right? Two straight series against Boston where he got suspended. You're like, you can't do this anymore. You can't have a guy who's going to eat 18 minutes a night and a key part of your team just be gone for large stretches of the Stanley Cup playoffs for reckless behavior. So he does it again, and you're like, this is unbelievable. This is like, why can't, Sean, and you watch this guy play a long time in Toronto, and I like Nazem. But why can't he dial it down in the Stanley Cup playoffs and find that line?
Yeah, there are just certain guys that struggle with this. And like, I'm with you. I like him too as a player. Obviously, as a Leafs fan and seeing the start of his career, I like him. And I think he's the sort of guy where when he's just going up to the line and not past it, there's a lot of room for him on a team. And you could say the same thing about other guys that you know, the Tom Wilsons and that sort of thing. You know, we always say, well, you'd take them on your team. And yeah, of course you would, but this one was painful. I mean, obviously the first thing you're thinking of is, you know, when anytime he does something like this, you hope the other guy's okay. You hope it's not an injury situation and that sort of thing. But it was tough. Cause I remember when Kadri was traded and that was the explanation at the time was, you know, the suspensions, you can't trust the guy. You know, he himself said, like, look, I'm not going to do it a third time. I mean, come on. I'm not going to. The first time he did it against Boston with the Leafs was dumb. The second time he was responding to a hit that had been thrown on a teammate, and it was still dumb because it was a completely over-the-top reaction. But it was at least you could kind of get into the mindset of, well, you know what, this is a team that gets pushed around and he wasn't going to let it happen and blah, blah, blah. With this one, this is just a dumb hit. You can't throw these hits. It's been 10 years now that we've had this rule in place. And you can't do it. And you can't do it in a close playoff game. And you can't do it in a blowout. And you can't do it in the preseason. And it doesn't matter. And it almost potentially could have cost the Avalanche the game last night because they were up two goals and cruising. And then they give up one power play goal on the 5-minute major, and luckily for them, don't give up the tying goal. I mean, you just can't do it. It's dangerous. This is not how the game is played anymore, should be played anymore, and the player ultimately has to be responsible. And unfortunately, like as we're talking, we're seeing the news kind of come across that he's been offered the dreaded in-person hearing. So you know what that means. He's going to get hammered on this one. I think this is it for him, at least in the series, and probably well beyond. And I don't like to see it because I like the player, but it's completely deserved. And it's on him absolutely. And there's no excusing these sorts of hits.
Yeah, it's funny. Like you bring up that, like, those are the hits that you saw, like, on Mark Savard or David Booth, right? Like, those hits from 10, 12 years ago, and you're like, yeah, it was like a throwback to that. So if Kadri, and you're pretty good when it comes to, like, history and knowing, like, some suspension history. Like, so this would be the third time, Sean, that Nazem Kadri would be suspended in the Stanley Cup playoffs. I would imagine that's a short list of guys that have been suspended, like, three times and more and up.
It has to be. I did a little bit of hunting around to see if I could find other people who fall into that category. I didn't see anyone, which doesn't necessarily mean that they're not out there, especially when you're talking about some of the smaller suspensions. But this is a league that doesn't like to suspend in the playoffs. This is a league that bends over backwards to not have guys miss time. And, because they, right or wrong, they view the playoffs as more valuable in terms of the offender. I mean, the argument against that has always been that, the guy he hurt is missing playoff games too. But they don't like to suspend in the playoffs. And the fact that it's been, you know, three times over the course of a career cannot be a long list. Three times in 4 years, I can't imagine there's many guys up there. I mean, Tom Wilson a few years ago had that playoffs where he was involved in multiple plays and they let him off the hook a couple of times. You know, Rafi Torres obviously comes to mind and some other guys. I can't off the top of my head, certainly. And if anyone knows of any, shoot them our way. We can talk about them. But three times in four postseasons, that's something else. And it's, you know, unfortunately, it's just a sign that this is a guy who is not getting it. Or maybe he's getting it when he walks out of the hearing, or he's getting it when he shows up at the rink. But there's just something when he's on the ice. And again, we've seen it with other guys. That filter isn't there. That moment of that decision making we've talked about, where when you see a guy open for a hit and you go, look, I can try to take him out of the play, or I can try to take him out of the game. And Kadri's a guy that likes to try to take guys out of the game. And sometimes if you can do it clean, even in today's NHL, maybe there's still room for that, but it's got to be clean. And that hit last night, I mean, as soon as you saw it, you knew that I don't know what he was going for, but he got him in the head, and it's been 10 years, so you can't do that. So there's no excuse for it.
The only one I can think of is Chris Pronger. I think got suspended twice in the same playoffs for Anaheim when they went to the Cup. I think he got suspended in the Western Final against Detroit, and then again in the Cup Final against Ottawa. So that's two times in 1 year for Pronger.
Yep. Yeah.
And the second time, Winnendale, he only
Pronger's
got one,
a good one to go to. That's
he got one game, which is it's still bananas to me that he got suspended in the Western Final and then again in the Cup Final, and it was one game.
But you know what? One game, and I think the series was like 1-1 at the time. You got to do a lot in this NHL to get suspended for to be a superstar too. I mean, we're not talking Aaron Rome or someone like that. We're talking Chris Pronger to get suspended like that. And the Stars do tend to get a little more leeway. Nazem Kadri has played like a star a few times. He's not at that level where I think he's going to get any leeway here. I think there's going to be a big message coming, and the message is, I mean, look, the Department of Player Safety, we all know they will give you one chance and two chances and more than that. But at some point it starts to just get embarrassing for them. And that's when they throw the book at you. And I don't think we're going to see a massive Rafi Torres type situation here. I think that would be unnecessary, but it's going to be a big suspension. And if you're a Blues fan, you don't have to worry about seeing Nazem Kadri again anytime soon.
You know, I think what I tried to pick your brain a little bit about how many times have we seen a player get suspended three times in the playoffs. Let me throw this one at you from a Washington Capitals perspective. How many times has a team started three different goalies in the first three games of a playoff series? Because that's exactly what the Capitals have done with Samsonov, Craig Anderson, and Vanacek. And they're down 2-1, but that's got to be I the go-to answer would be I'm sure the Philadelphia Flyers have done it at some point, right?
You know what? This is interesting because I tweeted a couple nights ago with Florida, because in Florida they had Sergei Bobrovsky start game one. They yank him out. They go to Chris Drager for game two. Everyone's waiting. You know, Spencer Knight's waiting in the wings. Is he going to be in there? And I pointed out, only because somebody had asked me the question a few days earlier, and it had been something I'd looked up. The last team to start three different goalies in the same playoff series and win the series was the Philadelphia Flyers. And it's interesting for a couple reasons. It was 2011, and it's a famous series. They beat the Sabres in seven games. They started with Bobrovsky. They went to Brian Boucher. Michael Layton came in, and then they went back to Boucher for game seven. And that did a couple of things. First of all, that's the series where Ville Leino scored the overtime goal against the Sabres. And then the Sabres go off in the offseason and they give him the big free agent contract. But even worse, that was the series that convinced the Flyers that we need one guy to be our goalie. And so they go out and they do the Ilya Bryzgalov trade signing. They trade away Richards and Carter and all of that stuff. So one series, two disastrous results for the teams involved. But what's interesting is, first of all, you're going back 10 years. And we were talking about it in terms of the Panthers maybe doing it. And who's the goalie for the Flyers that loses the job in game one? Sergei Bobrovsky, same guy as in Florida. Well, who was the coach of that 2011 Philadelphia Flyers? Peter Laviolette, who's now the coach of the Capitals. So maybe he's sitting there going, you know, I did it once, I can do it again. I know this only because they mentioned it on the broadcast last night. The last team to do it in the first three games, because that 2011 Flyers team, they spread it out a little. I think Bobrovsky started the first two, and Leighton didn't get in until game five. The first and maybe only other team to start a different goalie in each of the first three games was one of those mid-80s Winnipeg Jets teams. And it was just one of those years they're facing the Oilers, and it was probably like, all right, you get out there. Okay, we lost 10-1. Well, how about this guy? All right, that was 11-1. Let's try again. They were the last time to go three different starters in the first three games. That's almost unheard of, especially for a team like Washington that has Stanley Cup aspirations. It's not like they're floundering around with a rotten lineup. They just, the combination of circumstances being up against a real good opponent.
I'm thinking that 80s Jets, Daniel Berthiaume and Pokey Redick had to have been part of that. No?
Absolutely. Yeah. Bandit? This feels like a very Daniel Berthiaume type of statistic.
Yeah. I also have this vague memory in the early 90s of the Chicago Blackhawks having like Hasek and Belfour, and like maybe Greg Millen was part of the mix, and like they also had some kind of rotation of goalies, didn't they, at one point?
Yeah, they absolutely might have. I don't think
Jimmy Waite even.
It was, like, yeah. I mean, it was Belfour's net, but that was back in those days where certainly they didn't know what they had in Dominic Hasek for sure, and that was even our old pal that we talked about a few weeks ago, Roy LeBlanc, I think, was involved in that somehow, and it was. It's funny that you do get this with some teams where you just see guys kind of come in and out. And obviously if there's an injury or something like that, then you do what you have to do. But it's the list of teams that have even used three goalies in a playoff series is not a very long one. But I'll tell you this, if you're looking for good news, if you're a Washington fan, you're looking for some hope, is you actually don't have to go back that far to find a Stanley Cup winner that used three starters. Not in the same series, but in the same postseason, the Pittsburgh Penguins in 2016.
Oh,
everybody remembers that was the year that there was kind of the passing of the torch from Fleury to Matt Murray, and Fleury was hurt at first, and then Matt Murray kind of got the job and ran with it. But people forget. Do you remember who started?
Is it playoffs? Zatkoff?
Jeff Zatkoff.
Jeff Zatkoff
was the guy.
It. Yeah,
and I mean, you look at that. I mean, that was, you know, Mike Sullivan. This. Great job, but he looked at that team and was like, you know what, Matt Murray, you know what, Jeff Zatkoff's my guy. And they went in, and I don't think the first two games went very well, and they gave Matt Murray a try, and then the rest was history as far as the Penguins are concerned. But Jeff Zatkoff was the guy who started the playoffs as the Penguins' number one goalie.
So, you know, as we talk about the Capitals here, a just an egregious giveaway by Samsonov in double overtime. And I don't know if that's one of those things because you're into a double overtime. It's a classic mental mistake, but just a miscommunication with him and Schultz. And then Craig Smith comes in, wraps it in for the double overtime winner. And the television cameras catch Alexander Ovechkin, Sean, absolutely chewing out Samsonov as Samsonov leaves the ice. And it looks like Ovechkin's saying something. And he's heated. And now I see people saying, I can't believe Ovi showed up as goalie. Or what was he yelling? And I think it's interesting, right? Because if this was back in the day and it was like Mark Messier with the captain wearing the C, people would be like, that's what a leader does. He holds people accountable. Ovechkin does it. And you're like, well, I don't know. This guy is showing up as his goalie. I don't mind it. I think that shows you Alex Ovechkin has every right to be irate there. That was just such a poor... I don't know who to blame on that one. If it's Schultz, the defenseman, if it's Samsonov, but that's just terrible. And if you're the captain of the team, you have every right to light up your teammates there.
I think you've got every right, obviously, to be furious at how that played out and to rip into your teammates. I didn't love him doing it on the bench. I mean, the game's over. You're literally 10 steps away from being in the dressing room. Hold it together for a few more seconds, and then absolutely, we all know that you finish a game, you go, you close that door to the room, and then pretty much anything goes as far as what gets said, and I think that would be completely appropriate. I didn't love the fact that he's doing it on the bench. He knows the cameras are on him. He knows that this is going to become a story. But in the moment, the guy cares, right? And, you know, you're right. If it's messy, if Jonathan Toews does that, it's great leadership. And, you know, if other guys do it, then it shows that they're out of control or whatever else. We sort of fix the narrative to who the player is. So I didn't love it. And if I'm a teammate, I certainly don't necessarily appreciate that. I mean, I know I screwed up. I feel bad enough. Yeah, I don't need you ripping into me as I'm skating off the ice. But again, it certainly shows, you know, with Ovechkin, there was some talk, you know, last year in the play when they did, the Capitals didn't look super great in the postseason, thinking, well, maybe this guy's already got his cup. Maybe he's got, maybe one's enough. He looks dialed in this series. And you know, from the big hit that he threw early in game one and this guy cares. We're getting beast mode Alexander Ovechkin. I didn't love the stuff on the bench, but if that's the price of admission to get a dialed in, focused Ovechkin, then I think if you're a Caps fan, you take that every day.
Yeah, see, I think I like it, and I think it's because we do such a job of like sort of muting hockey players, right? And we don't see the true emotion, and we get these cliche answers. It's like, well, there's a window into what he actually thinks, right? Rather than 25 minutes later, Ovechkin's going to get on a Zoom call and he's just going to say, hey, we win as a team, lose as a team. Well, no, there's the window. He's like, he's frustrated. And I kind of like that from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, and it, look, it's not like we learned anything that we didn't know, right? It's not like anyone's like, oh, hey, the Alexander Ovechkin seemed unhappy that they blew a double overtime. No, you're right. It doesn't tell us anything we don't know. Again, I hold it in for five more seconds, get to the room, and then scream as much as you want. But it's hard to blame them.
A quick thought here. Look, Washington's down 2-1. That series has been great. You know, overtime games, one goal games. Florida Panthers treated, and the Tampa Bay Lightning treated everybody to a spectacular opening game. But then Tampa Bay exerted their dominance in game two, which has a lot of people wondering, Sean, are the Florida Panthers done at 0-2? Can they come back and beat the defending Stanley Cup champions four times in five games?
It's a real tough ask. That's a big hill to climb. I'm not going to say they can't do it. Again, this is the modern NHL. It's a lot of these games come down to coin flips, and the coin might land the right way four times out of five, but it's real tough. I mean, that first game, first of all, that first game was phenomenal. That was just absolutely. I was. Like a lot of people, I was rooting for this series to happen. I think, wouldn't it be great if the two Florida teams finally played? And that game just blew away any expectations that you could have had. And our pal Sean Gentile wrote the piece where it was the first time fans watching that. We've talked a lot on this show and elsewhere about how the NHL product, a lot of times, if it's your first time sitting down to watch it and you see some 2-1 game, you might never be back because it's not, the entertainment value isn't high. That was the sort of game, man. I hope there were some first-time hockey fans watching that because they're hooked now. That is the best that they can offer. It was great. Game two, I mean, I guess we should have seen it coming, right? When two teams play an excellent end-to-end entertaining game, the focus always seems to shift to how do we shut this down and get this into something that looks a little more different, low event, low scoring. The thing with Florida is I'm looking at this and I'm going, man, we took our best swings with these guys. And the one thing that my question going into this, as far as the Lightning, and my concern was the health of the guys, and especially Nikita Kucherov. We all knew he was coming back. We all knew from the very beginning of the season he was going to miraculously be okay for game one of the playoffs. But I really felt like, you know, hold on a second. We're all assuming he's just going to show up and he's going to be 100% powered up Nikita Kucherov. And there's no reason to think that. We've seen guys come back from injuries. I mean, look at Vladimir Tarasenko. He comes back, doesn't look anywhere near the same sort of player. That happens a lot to guys. It might take a while to get going. And against a team as good as Florida, who knows? Put that out of your mind. Nikita Kucherov shows up game one. He is absolute full power. He doesn't look like he missed a beat. That scares me if I'm Florida and I'm just sitting there going, you know, the Panthers played two good games. They took two real good swings. They've already played the goalie card and Tampa's standing there and they don't, they haven't taken a step back yet. And that does worry me. And I don't want to get ahead of myself. Still a long way to go in this series, potentially. Florida Panthers could still pull this off, but there is a part of me that's just looking at that Panthers franchise going, man, you've been waiting almost 30 years to get this shot. Haven't won a playoff series in 25 years. This is the best team that you've probably had, maybe in franchise history. Boy, if they go into this and they just get swept aside by the Lightning, like the scrawny little brother, that's going to sting. That's going to really leave a mark on the team going forward, because this is nobody says you have to beat the Tampa Bay Lightning. They're the defending champs. They're an amazing team, but you got to get them in a fight, and you got to let them know that they were in a fight, as far as just in a tough series where they felt like they had their backs to the ropes a few times. And so far, Panthers have played well, but they got to get some wins.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, Sean. Well, listen, we're going to go from talking about Lightning and Panthers. We're going to kind of look at things from a favorite and underdog perspective league-wide as we bring in Jesse Granger for a little Granger Things. As always, this segment is sponsored by BetMGM, the exclusive betting partner with us here at The Athletic. Welcome back to the show. As always, Jesse, love having you. And I got to ask you first, what has been the atmosphere inside T-Mobile Arena? Because for those, Sean and I we're in Canada, and we can't even fathom. They're talking about maybe 2,500 Habs fans might get to go to a game. So I think a lot of us on this side of the border are looking down at these games, and it's like, this feels like another planet. You're there. I mean, what's the atmosphere like? Because it looks absolutely electric for a Vegas Golden Knights playoff game.
Yeah, it's been pretty awesome. I can't wait for you guys to get some fans in the buildings, especially you mentioned Montreal. That Toronto-Montreal series deserves fans. I think we've been waiting forever to get that, and those games are significantly better with fans in the building. It's funny because in normal Golden Knights standards, an 8,000 people in the arena is an empty building. It's half full. You'd think it wouldn't be great. Like, you'd think it would seem like, this building's half full. But after a year of watching empty arenas, it's amazing what 8,000 people in the building does. I've seen over in Carolina, they've got 12,000, I think. Nashville's going to get around the same. It feels full. It definitely does. It's not the 18,000 shoulder to shoulder that they're used to prior to the global pandemic, but it is definitely a very nice sign, and it feels more like playoff hockey because it's without the fans in the building. It's just not the same. I think we kind of took fans for granted for so long because we were just so used to them being there and being loud all the time. This last year has really showed us how much the fans really do add to the important feel of the game.
Well, and I think we want to know too, like, okay, there's certainly a little bit of atmosphere in the games. Are we starting to see early in the Stanley Cup playoffs here, Jesse, any trends as it pertains to home and road? Is there home ice advantage with having, you know, 5, 10, 12,000 people cheering you on? Or is it, are we seeing the opposite effect here?
Yeah, it's funny. So last year was the home team, well, home team, and I put that in air quotes because obviously in the bubbles in Edmonton and Toronto, there were no actual home teams. But the team with the last change, actually had a losing record last year, and it's not the first time ever. Actually, 3 years ago, the home teams had a losing record, and that was when everyone was traveling and playing in full buildings under normal circumstances. So it's not super rare for the road teams to win a lot of games in the Stanley Cup playoffs. But this year, early on, the home team has had an advantage. They're 8-6 so far, so it's not a super big advantage. If you lose one more, you're 7-7 split. So it hasn't been that big of an advantage for the home ice. And actually, when the Golden Knights got approved to allow more people into the building, I kind of went back and looked and saw if the fans in the building make a statistical difference. And to this point, they don't, which is kind of surprising. But if you ask any player, they will tell you it absolutely matters. And the momentum swings are a lot bigger when there are fans in the home building. What has happened this year, though, is the favorites are playing unbelievably well. And it's funny because I remember looking back at the beginning of the playoffs, and I remember thinking after the first few games, like, man, this playoffs is going to be wild, because three of the first four games, the underdog won. Washington beat Boston in the opening game. New York Islanders shocked the Penguins, and then Minnesota was the biggest underdog, and they beat Vegas here in Vegas for that huge win in game one. But since those first three games, three of the first four, the underdogs won, the favorites have gone 9-1. And the only one that the underdogs have won since then was Winnipeg over Edmonton last night. So in between there, you had nine straight favorites win. And the favorites have won 71% of the games so far, which is an astounding number, because last year, favorites only won 54% of the total playoff games, just barely over half if you're betting the favorite every time. Whereas this year, 71%, a 10-4 record for the favorites is really impressive. If you were just blindly betting the favorite in every game right now, you'd be making a lot of money.
But see, what I really like about that is you've planted a seed of doubt in Sean's mind, because in the North Division, the favorite has yet to win a game. That's the way I'm looking at it.
They're 0-1.
That's right. We're like a week into the playoffs, and it's still the favorites are 0-4 in the North. What's going on?
Yeah, tonight, Toronto's a big favorite, one of the bigger favorites at minus 200. There haven't been many minus 200 favorites. The lines have been very close in these playoffs.
Yeah, and you know, and maybe let's talk a bit about that. Some of these, some of the puck line bets, for example, probably aren't hitting because of some of the the tightly contested nature of some of these games, right?
Exactly right. Yeah. So for anyone listening that doesn't know, that's not a big hockey gambler, puck line is taking a team to win by two goals. You're taking a minus a goal and a half, meaning you're taking the favorite, and you can only take the favorite on the puck line. Some places will offer a reverse puck line, but for the most part, you're taking the favorite minus a goal and a half, and it changes the odds drastically. Just for example, Toronto, I mentioned minus 200 tonight. You've got to bet 200. You've got to bet double to win $100. You might not want to do that, but if you bet Toronto minus a goal and a half, saying Toronto will win by two, that minus 200 turns into a plus 140. So a $100 bet actually wins you $140. Pretty significant difference. With the way the favorites are winning, you would think puck line's the way to go, because you can get good odds on them and they're winning every night. There's chances of them getting an empty netter. You can win by two. But actually, these games, I mean, obviously, when they go to overtime, you've lost your puck line bet because it's going to be a one-goal game. And with that Boston-Washington series, every game's going to overtime. We've seen a lot of overtime games. Puck line has not been the way to go. If you were to bet the favorite puck line every time this playoffs, you would have gone 6-8 for 42%. And just to show how bad that is, I just mentioned last year, the favorites only covered 54% of the time. But when they won, 57% was a win for the puck line. This year, that dropped to 42%. So while the favorites are winning, they are not winning by much. Almost all of these games have been decided by one goal. And in the few that have been a two-goal game, it's been the heavy, heavy favorites. Colorado has had their way with St. Louis, and they're minus like in the 300s. So it has not been an easy road if you're trying to get those better odds and win the puck line bets.
I think I saw a stat at some point. I think we were four or five games into the playoffs before any team had a two-goal lead at any time, let alone at the final buzzer. It's been one-goal hockey the whole way. And you know what? I'm good with that. People can bet however they want, but if you're making a bet that makes you root against playoff overtime,
right,
then I got to question that. That's rough.
It has been awesome. It's been great.
I got a question here for both of you guys to kind of wrap this up. And Connor McDavid got shut out in the opener against Winnipeg. What's your confidence level? Like, if you guys were putting down money, like, and I'm just going to say, let's set it at 1.5 points. Connor McDavid game two, 1.5 points. What are you guys doing?
I'm taking the over 1.5, especially after zero. Like, I would have taken over 1.5 just period. Coming off of a game with 0 points, I feel a lot more confident in that. What about you, Sean?
Yeah, I'd go the over there, because the thing is, like, full credit to the Jets, but it's not like you were watching that game going, oh, the Jets have figured this out. The Jets have come up with some new system that he's really struggling with. It just was one of those nights. I think that, you had Pierre Maguire on NBC saying that Nathan MacKinnon's the best player in the league. Like, Connor McDavid seems like the sort of guy who'll find out about that and maybe have a little something to say about it.
Yeah, and you know that Sidney Crosby's also seeing that clip, and he's like, oh, just
yes
irate, right? There's a couple of guys that seems to fire up. Hey, listen, Jesse, this is great. Appreciate our Granger Things visit as always, because I think it's certainly in the Stanley Cup playoffs, people are trying to jump on some trends early on. And so great to get your insight on that. Enjoy the remainder of that wild. I know that's been a bit of a house of horrors for the Vegas Golden Knights in Minnesota. So that should be pretty interesting to watch the rest of that series play out. So looking forward to your coverage there, and we'll hit you up again next week.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks, Jesse.
When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. When you're trying to grow a business, the caliber of person you bring in to help you do that is really important. And LinkedIn makes it really easy to interview the right people for the role, quality people. LinkedIn isn't just a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/NHL show. That's linkedin.com/NHL show to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
All right, time for us to kind of open up the mailbag a little bit, answer some of our listener questions. A reminder, drop us an email. You can hit us up. It is theathletichockeyshow@gmail.com. Theathletichockeyshow@gmail.com. Or we'd love to hear your voice. Trust me, we love to hear your voice. And you can actually leave us a voicemail. That number, it's 845-445-8459. All right, actually, we're going to take some Twitter questions today because this is pretty fun. We got some questions on social media thrown our way. Sean, Some listeners are noticing that when watching the Stanley Cup Finals, and there's been a bunch of playoff games here in the first week, that midway through the overtime session, there is a commercial break. And this note comes in from one of our listeners and followers on social media. Says, hey, I thought in previous years there were no TV timeouts in overtime. What's going on? And are overtime TV timeouts a new thing? So that I think that's a legitimate question. Yep. I have no recollection. I don't think that there was any TV timeouts in at least like 3-4 years ago. I don't think there was TV timeouts in overtime, right?
No, that was always the thing, was that there was no commercials in overtime. And I don't know exactly when it started, but I did notice it this week. You know, it was one of the early overtime games, and you sit there and all of a sudden a commercial comes on. And you and I talked about it. I think what's happening is they're doing that kind of quick dry scrape during the around the 10-minute mark, just to try to keep the ice quality as good as they can deep into a long game. And I guess they figured that they can squeeze an ad break in there. Okay, it's fine. It's a game changer though, because we've all had that experience. Where you're sitting down to watch that overtime game, and you know maybe you're cracking open the second or third beer, and suddenly you get halfway through and you go, well, there's no commercial breaks for me to zip off to the bathroom. This is, I've made a horrible strategic error here. Now you've got that 10-minute mark to look forward to. So adjust your overtime habits accordingly.
Yeah, and so what I can't figure, it's I think the rule is it's the first whistle after the halfway point of the period. So after you hit 10 minutes, first whistle, TV timeout. But I'm with you. I don't think that was happening 2 or 3 years ago in the Stanley Cup playoffs. Because regular season, you're so used to it, right? It's at the, you know, we all know this, you know, 6-minute mark and the 10-minute mark, all that. I'm thrown off. And you know, all this does for me, it's one opportunity to potentially miss a play. Either the broadcast doesn't come back in time, or worse, you as the viewer are like, I got to make a quick trip to the bathroom. I'm going to grab a drink.
Go check another game. You got to be careful. Oh, yeah.
But
I'll tell you, the one nice thing about it though is, you know, the other you talk about during the regular season, the scheduling, and one thing that I think most fans know or have figured out is you can't have a commercial if it's in the middle of a power play or if a penalty has just been called, they won't put the commercial in there. And you don't have to worry about that in playoff overtime because there has never been a penalty called in playoff overtime. So it's one less thing for them to have to worry about.
Oh, I love it. Okay, this one comes in from Luke, who says, and then we kind of talked about this with Jesse Granger a little bit in Granger Things. Luke wants to know, how do you guys view the TV experience with no fans in the stands? Because watching the beginning of Edmonton-Winnipeg, it feels like something is missing after watching the games based in the United States. I couldn't agree more with Luke. It was stark. And I know that they try to do the whole thing in Winnipeg with the anthem where they pipe in the everyone chants True North during the anthem. It's missing. And you can feel, I think if this Montreal-Toronto series gets to a game six, and in that game six, 2,500 Montreal fans are allowed in the building, it's going to be bizarre. It's going to be it's going to be a huge difference maker, or at least it's going to be a change in the environment. It's mind-blowing to me. Watching these games in Florida and Vegas, it honestly feels like we're in another country. Not a country, like another league. We're watching another sport in another league.
Yeah, it is. I remember even going into the bubble last year where they were going to play without fans, and I wrote and I said, we don't know how this is going to feel as viewers. This might really throw us off. And I don't know about you, but when I sat down to watch the games, it wasn't that bad. I got used to the tarps pretty quick. The fake crowd noise was okay. The only times that it really stood out to me was a couple of times that last year and this year too, where guys got hurt and they would just shut all the noise down. And I remember when Jake Muzzin got hurt against Columbus, it was just so dead silent that it really drove home that this was an empty building. And then the other game this season, and most of this season we haven't seen fans in any of the buildings. The game that really jumped out to me was that Capitals Rangers game with all the fights where there was, there were, I think, a few fans in the building, but I'm just sitting there going like, man, the roof should be coming off this place. And it just seems very strange that this is all happening without much noise. But it never really bothered me, day to day, never really stood out. But now we're definitely seeing it because you've got these crowds coming down in the U.S. and they're great crowds and they're playoff crowds. And yeah, you can't watch what's happening in Carolina and then flip over to Edmonton, Winnipeg or Toronto, Montreal. It's really going to stand out. It's really going to feel noticeable. And, again, we'll adjust. And I don't think it's going to make the games unwatchable or anything like that, but it really is going to be a big difference. And I'm still very interested to see what happens when whoever emerges from this Canadian division goes down to the States. And, we think that we're going to have, fans in Montreal for game six, if the series gets there, but you could absolutely have a team win the North Division that has not played a game in front of a single fan all year. And then they go down and they play game one in Vegas with a nearly full building, knowing how loud that, you talk about home ice advantage, that's just going to be completely off the charts. That's a long way down the road and fingers crossed, maybe we'll get some fans in buildings in Canada before that. But, I made it until this week without feeling like it was really, really noticeable. But yeah, that Edmonton game last night, it after watching everything down in the States, it was very noticeable.
Yeah, exactly. And so I don't know what's going to happen in the weeks ahead, but you're right. Like just, it's such a stark difference. All right. Over to this week in hockey history. Okay. This week in hockey history, and there's a couple of interesting things. We're gonna go take our listeners back to May 21st of 1970. Okay, at May 21st, 1970, it's the off season, and the Montreal Canadiens engineer a trade with the California Golden Seals, which allows them down the road to select Guy Lafleur. And I gotta tell you, if I had a time machine, I'd be going back and warning every general manager, don't deal with the Habs. Like you're about to get fleeced. And can you explain to our listeners how the California Golden Seals, Sean, would have essentially given up Guy Lafleur to the Montreal Canadiens?
The Montreal Canadiens were very smart. This is Sam Pollock. This is why Sam Pollock is the name that comes up first when people, even these days, talk about the greatest GMs ever. And this was a thing that he and the Montreal Canadiens did over and over again, especially to the new expansion teams. They would go to them and they'd say, we'll give you a couple of good players, not stars, but we'll give you a couple of good players now, and you give us your first round pick or even the option to flip first round picks years down the road. Like, there were some of these, they were making trades 4 years down the road. And, you know, I think the thinking with these expansion teams was, hey, we got to get some good players right now. The future is the future. We're not too worried about it. I'm the GM. I might not even be the GM by then, so who cares? And they did it over and over again. And Guy Lafleur is the big one, but there are other cases where you go down that 70s dynasty. They got built largely through making these sorts of deals where they were getting banking picks years down the line. And in a lot of cases, knowing who the players might be available, even if it was a few years down the line, they would sit there and go, yeah, this is going to be the Guy Lafleur draft. This is going to be, you know, whoever else, up to and including the getting a first round pick in the 1980 draft that famously ends up being the first overall pick, and they use it on Doug Wickenheiser instead of Danny Savard, who was the local kid that they were expected to take, and that ends up being a big bust. But the thing that people forget about 1980 is when the Canadiens made that trade 4 years, or I think it was in 76, they acquired that pick. We didn't know how the draft was going to work out. There was a chance that that might be the Wayne Gretzky draft. And there's a lot of people who think that that's what the Canadiens were thinking ahead of. Let's bank this. And it's just interesting to me because you never see it these days. These days, the only time you'll see a first round pick more than a year in advance is if it's like a protected pick and the team says, oh, we don't want to give it up. And so it kicks ahead a year. But you don't see teams going out there saying, yeah, we'll trade you this guy. You don't want to give up your first round pick this year? Give us your first round pick 4 years from now. And you look at if I was trying to trade for picks this year, I don't know if I want a first round pick this year. I want give me a lottery ticket for the Connor Bedard draft or something like that. You know, give me a shot at somebody like that. It's a good strategy as long as you as a GM feel confident that you're going to still be around to make that pick. I think this should come back, but it probably doesn't because it worked so well for the Canadiens that any GM who tried to move a pick well into the future would probably immediately start hearing about Guy Lafleur and probably lose their nerve.
I wonder, too, if Guy Lafleur ends up with the California Golden Seals, does that franchise survive? Does Guy Lafleur just become a draft bust? Like, what? How do you think that plays out? Yeah. Guy Lafleur in Oakland.
It's, you know what? It's a real good question. I don't think Guy Lafleur ends up being Guy Lafleur, but maybe he does. It, you know, remember, this is Disco Guy. This is the guy who put his own disco album out a few years later. Maybe the California vibe would have been a good one for him. But geez, that draft is such a memorable one because and Montreal was so smart because they knew it wasn't just Guy Lafleur draft. There were two guys. Number two pick that year, Marcel Dion. Imagine him in Montreal. I mean, that would have been another building block for your dynasty. So they knew what they were doing. If I had a time machine, man, I would go back to the early 70s and I would tell every NHL GM, if you see that Montreal area code, if you pick up the phone and it's Sam Pollock, hang up because you are going to get fleeced. Sam Pollock is the sort of guy, if he was in your fantasy football league, you would kick him out because he kept making lopsided trades that ruined the league for everyone else. He was light years ahead of everybody else as far as doing that job.
Actually, so now I'm thinking about, imagine there could have been a great California rivalry between Marcel Dion and Guy Lafleur in the state of California.
There it is. That could have been it. And instead, tragically, Montreal Canadiens' success.
Yeah. Yeah. I also still never understand why the Detroit Red Wings traded Marcel Dion. Like, I know that there was some contractual stuff. That guy was like in his early 20s and putting up huge numbers. And they're like, nah. It's just not going to work for us.
It was contractual, and there was like even a free agency component to it back in the day where we didn't really have free agency, but players could sort of say, I want to go here and force you into it. And I don't think it was fully their choice, but that's certainly one where you look back and I don't know, a Detroit franchise that has a history with guys like Gordie Howe, Steve Yzerman, Nicholas Lidstrom keeping their stars forever. They missed on that one.
Yeah, Mike Modano, Daniel Alfredson, some of the great
those guys. Solving. Okay. Sure, yeah.
Yeah. One other this week in hockey history, May 19th, 1994. It's one of the great calls of all time. Mateau, and the New York Rangers knock off the New Jersey Devils in Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Final to advance to the Stanley Cup, which they would ultimately win in 7 games against Vancouver. I asked this question. So removing the Stanley Cup Final from the equation and just looking at anything that would have happened in the playoffs but not in the final, where does Stefan Matteau's goal rank on like a power ranking of the biggest goals not in the Cup final?
Yeah, it's way up there, and it might be number one, at least in the modern era. If you're taking out, if you're NHL only and we're taking out like milestone goals and stuff like that, because that's a different category, it might be right up there. I've had some fun with it in the past and joked about it, but that 94 Rangers team, it feels like that's the only team from history that anyone at the NHL headquarters knows exists, and anyone in the NHL marketing department, because that period of time, you had Mark Messier's guarantee and the hat trick in Game 6, the Stefan Matteau goal, and then of course they go and they finally end the drought by winning the Stanley Cup against the Canucks. Years later, this league still loves to bring that up and haul those guys out, and it doesn't happen if it's not for the Stefan Matteau goal. It would rank high up there. It's definitely very high also on my list of the worst great goals of all time, because it's a terrible goal. It is such an ugly.
It's like a wraparound, right?
But it's not even a wraparound. It's a wraparound, and he throws it out front, and I think it's Scott Niedermayer basically knocks it into his own net. It's not even a. Like Matteau tucks it in. He just lucks into it. But it would be right up there. I'll give you a couple. Let me give you one other nomination for the greatest non-final goal ever. Because I do think we're probably looking at Game 7 overtime goals. I'm not sure that you can find any goal that's going to be bigger than that. And this one is a personal favorite. And unlike Stefan Matteau, this isn't an ugly goal. This is one of the most beautiful goals that you'll ever see. And that is 1996, Steve Yzerman, double overtime against the St. Louis Blues. That famous slap shot where there's the shot from right behind the net, and you just see the puck going in and beating John Casey. Great goal, an amazing goal, but that you look at the history around it. First of all, that was the Detroit team that they had one of the best regular seasons in history. They're playing round two. They're playing a Blues team that is not very good. If they lose to the Blues, that Detroit team probably gets blown up. And maybe Steve Yzerman gets traded to Ottawa. Maybe all this other stuff that was rumored to be happening actually happens. Maybe Wayne Gretzky stays in St. Louis if they go on a deep run. But the big one for me is by scoring that goal, winning that series, Detroit moves on to the conference final where they face a team that they have no history whatsoever against, the Colorado Avalanche. And of course, that's the series where Claude Lemieux hits Chris Draper from behind, and that launches the greatest rivalry in modern hockey history. And if Wayne Gretzky doesn't cough up the puck in overtime to Steve Yzerman, we maybe never get any of that. And geez, I mean, the whole modern history of the NHL changes based on that one goal.
Yeah, that's a great call. And it was only, like you said, it was only round two, but it certainly gave birth to a great dynasty. You know, the one guy who I don't think gets any or enough credit for scoring what should be an iconic Game 7 overtime goal, it's Alec Martinez.
Like, yes.
Why don't we talk about Alec Martinez? Guy scores a Game 7 overtime goal to end what some people say was the most entertaining playoff series of all time, that Western Final, mm-hmm. Chicago-LA, and then the guy rolls in and scores the cup-winning goal too, and yet he just doesn't. Like you said, maybe he should have played for the 94 Rangers, but like Alec Martinez just doesn't get enough love.
Yeah, you think he would be the captain clutch, but it just doesn't seem to happen. That's up there. I'll give you one more that came to mind. And this team didn't end up winning the Stanley Cup, but I almost wish this goal didn't happen because I would have loved to have seen the fallout. But Alex Burrows in 2011 for the Canucks against the Blackhawks. After they had 2 years in a row, Chicago beats Vancouver 2 years in a row. Vancouver's got the President's Trophy. This is their cup team. They meet up with the Hawks in round one again. and they roll them. They beat them the first three games. They're up 3-0. It's going to be a sweep. Then Chicago wins game four. And then they win game five, and you're thinking, oh, no. And then they win game six, and you're thinking, if Vancouver collapses and blows a 3-0 lead, that's it. You have to blow up the whole team. You have to dismantle the team. There's no way. And it goes to overtime. And in fact, I think it didn't, doesn't Chicago tie it with like seconds left in regulation?
Well, I think Chicago, if memory serves me, I think Jonathan Taves scores Taves, a shorthanded goal.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
Like late, like with like 2 minutes left or something.
I mean, you talk about the most painful, that would be the most, I believe, most painful playoff loss in history if Vancouver had lost that game in overtime. And instead, Burrows gets the turnover and just steps in and wires it. And I mean, every overtime goal is a combination of joy and relief. But that one, if you've never seen relief on the faces of fans and players and everything like that one just stuck with me. And certainly if Vancouver had gone on and won the cup that year, which they should have, we probably have that ranked at the very top of this list.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. The Dragon Slayer goal, as they call it out in Vancouver. All right, Sean, this was a ton of fun, as always. We want to remind people that, I didn't get a chance, I'll be honest here, full disclosure, I didn't get a chance to download and listen to Custance and Gentile. They had Ryan Miller on Tuesday, but they said they leaned in hard, Sean, into the whole American thing. And, you know, they did. They definitely leaned in. And wanted to give our listeners an American feel to the Tuesday edition of the show.
I went to check it, but there was like a skill testing question. It said, spell the word color. And as soon as I hit the letter U, it just took me right out, right off the screen. So I don't know.
We can't download the episode. But hey, listen, this was a ton of fun. And listen, best of luck to your Toronto Maple Leafs. This is going to be at the very least, this is going to be entertaining, I think, for all of us in Canada to watch. So and all of us in North America to watch. So listen, enjoy the series, and we'll do this again next week.
Yeah, thanks. And I feel like you don't really mean it on the good luck, but I will take it in the spirit.
Yeah. You can. You can sense my lack of sincerity there. Hey, listen, thanks, though. I am being sincere here when I say thanks to everybody for joining us for this edition of the Athletic Hockey Show. We'll get you again next week. Like I said, check out that new Tuesday edition of the show, Craig Custance, Sean Gentile. You should be able to have it in your feed. Just download the episode. They had Ryan Miller on with them. And like I said, drop us an email, theathletichockeyshow@gmail.com. The voicemail, it's super simple too, 845-445-8459. If you're not a subscriber, you can join us at theathletic.com/hockeyshow.